Day, and that means we're going to be reading from The Spirits of Christmas, The Dark Side of the Holidays. Be back. Grab your popcorn and snacks. Find a comfy spot, take a seat or lie down, and let me transport you to a place of fantasy, ghost stories, ancient legends, odd creatures, alien encounters, and other magical topics. You may even decide to join the conversation. From faraway lands to your own backyard, with a small dash of pixie dust, turn out the lights and open your minds. The journey is about to begin. Good evening, everybody. Happy Sunday. I hope everybody's had a great weekend. I know I've had a good weekend. I'm still tired, though, but I had a great weekend. Other than that, I got lots of paperwork to fill out for tomorrow. I got an early day. I don't know what possessed me to set up my medical appointment for 8 a.m. I must have been smoking something. I don't know. You know, just in one of those moods. How's everybody doing today? Everybody good? Okay. Just making sure, let me make an adjustment over here on TikTok, and we'll get rolling. Hang on. Let me make sure we're on the right settings. Yeah. All right. I don't think I flipped this usually. I'm just realizing how much I flipped it. Okay. Well, my name is Charlotte. I'm going to be your host for the next hour. I'm also the owner of the California Haunts Paranormal Investigation Team, Sacramento, California. We are 45 strong up and down the state, which means if you think you have a paranormal need, we can help you. It might take us a while to get to you, but we can definitely help you. Okay? This is my other job, you guys. This is my other job. Normally, on the evenings, I do tarot card readings, except Sundays. So that's why people on TikTok are looking at me like I'm crazy. So I do have a gift goal over on TikTok, and that is for 10 rock stars. If you guys can do that for me, that would be great. No one's required to gift, however. If you do decide to gift, please do me a favor. You know, if you don't, please do me a favor and just like, share, and follow. Okay, that's all I ask. But if you do decide to gift, just know that it does not go to me. It goes to my paranormal team. Just like that thing rolling down there. That's at the bottom of this thing, right over here, for you other guys. Just know that it goes to my paranormal team, and it's for their expenses and not mine. I'm here volunteering my time. Okay? Do double tap that screen. We'll try to get as many likes as we can today. I don't know if we're going to finish this book yet. We're getting really close to the end. This is our holiday book that we read. It's gone on pretty long, and it's got some interesting stories, so we're going to have a lot of Christmas hauntings and ghost stories still to go here. But, yeah, so just stick with me. We've got an hour, you know, like my intro says, for the people that hear my intro. Put your fuzzies on, grab some hot cocoa, turn down the lights, and let's get spooked. So again, I'll read for about an hour, and then we'll call it a day, okay? Here we go. And this is my smaller tablet. I have a nice 10-inch tablet. But this one came through on Kindle, so it's on this tablet. So here we go. This section is called Christmas Hauntings. All right? So Billy and Linda Miklos and their children, Billy Jr. and Nicole, live in a gorgeous 18th-century farmhouse in Allentown, Pennsylvania. They moved into the house in 1977 and discovered, almost immediately, that they were sharing their new home with more than one ghost. For several nights after they moved in, Linda and Billy were kept awake by the thundering hoofbeats of a horse that galloped in circles around the house. The galloping was so energetic that the couple could hear the horse's hooves kicking up gravel, but there was no gravel and there was no horse. The house is set in the deep woods, with only soft forest stuff around it. Soon after that, Linda began to hear children's voices calling, "Mommy, Mommy." Billy Jr. spoke of seeing a small girl walking close to Linda. Unnerved, but also intrigued, Linda did some research into the house. She traced its history all the way back to the first settler, George Schubert, a soldier in the Revolutionary War. Schubert had built a cabin on the property. The cabin later burned to the ground. Then Schubert built the farmhouse that now stands on the property. Shortly after the house was built, five of the Schubert children died of smallpox within a week. With such tragedy in his past, it's no wonder the house is a magnet for spirit energy. Linda started a diary to keep track of all the paranormal events in the house. She discovered that much of the activity happens in April and around Christmas. On Christmas Eve, 1981, 8-year-old Billy Jr. and his sister Nicole were sleeping in Billy's room while with the door open. Nicole was restless and kept waking up. Suddenly, she shook Billy awake and pointed to the door. A glowing figure stood beside the door to their parents' room. As they watched it, it vanished. During another Christmas season, the Miklases invited a friend of theirs, Larry, to stay with them for the holiday. Larry was a Vietnam vet who had just gone through the breakup of his marriage. The Miklases had cut their tree and carried it home a couple of days before Christmas, and Linda felt that Larry would welcome an invitation to help decorate the tree. The weather was unseasonably warm, but Linda felt that a fire in the fireplace would add to the festive air. Larry decorated the tree while Billy carried in some wood and got the fire going. Linda brought in snacks for the men as they worked. When the men were finished, they all sat down to relax and to enjoy the crackling fire and the colorful tree. Someone, though, didn't seem to appreciate Larry's decorating efforts. The tree started shaking violently, and all the ornaments fell off and rolled across the floor. Billy stood up, about to give the cat holy hell for jumping on the tree, but the cat was nowhere in the room. Then the room turned icy cold. Knowing that a severe drop in temperature can sometimes announce a ghostly manifestation, Billy decided to try an experiment. Linda had arranged colored balls in a sleigh as a decoration for the mantelpiece. Billy spoke to the empty air. "Listen, if anybody is really here, knock the balls out of the sleigh." 10 minutes later, a ball rose from the sleigh and dropped with a click onto the mantel. There was a small building on the property that had been the groom's quarters when the land was a horse farm. Larry had lived in the building for a while, but had moved out. He later unaltered himself. Billy had lit a kerosene heater in the building to keep the pipes from freezing. On December 23, 1983, Billy was deathly sick, far too sick to get out of bed. By Christmas Day, he was feeling better. The first thing he did was go to the outbuilding to check on the kerosene heater, which would run only 24 hours on one tank. "That should have been bone drying out," he said. But when he got to the building to check the heater, it was full of fuel. Billy couldn't explain how the heater got filled, but he suspects maybe Larry returned to do his friend a favor. During another Christmas, the Miklases had a relative from Ohio come to visit. Sometime between 1:30 and 2 a.m., Angie came suddenly awake. A loud scratching noise had pulled her from sleep. It started at the top of the stairway and grew fainter near the bottom, as if a large dog was walking down the stairs. About 20 minutes later, Angie heard a crash from the kitchen, as if a metal tray had fallen off the counter. A few minutes after that, Angie said she sensed a friendly presence sitting on a chair in the loft where she was trying to sleep. And according to Linda's haunting diary, on Wednesday night, December 18th, 1985, the bedroom reading at 11 o'clock at night while Billy was taking a shower. I'm sorry, she was in the bedroom reading at 11 o'clock at night while Billy was taking a shower in the basement. As Linda read, she heard piano music filling the house. Billy barged into the bedroom, his face half covered with shaving lotion. "Tell me you were just playing the piano, Linda," he begged. She shook her head. That was the one and only time the piano played a phantom tune. It never happened again. The Calvert Mansion. Lord Calvert's mansion stands in Riverdale, Maryland. It's a late Gregorian plantation house that was built between 1801 and 1807. It was rumored to be haunted by Lord Calvert's son-in-law, who unalived himself from a tree in the front yard. The mansion is now a museum, but in 1972, it was occupied by 75-year-old Mr. Smith. He was uncomfortable rattling around the haunted mansion by himself, so he asked Rick, a deputy sheriff in Prince George's County, to move in with him for protection. One December night, while Mr. Smith was out visiting friends for Christmas, Rick was outside in the barn tending to his horses. His chores done, he started for the house and noticed that the light in the attic was on. For a moment, he just stood and stared at it. He knew the attic wasn't wired for electricity, but he could plainly see the rafters through the window. The light source was strong, not flickering. It had to be coming from inside the attic. Rick's police training kicked in, and he rushed into the house in search of an intruder. He secured all three of the lower floors, making sure all of the house's outside doors were locked. Then he headed to the attic. Slowly, Rick pushed the attic door open. Only darkness met his eyes. Rick knew he'd seen light in that attic less than 5 minutes ago. There was a lamp in the attic for emergencies, but the bulb was completely cold. The deputy shivered. None of his police training had prepared him for seeing a bright light in an attic window. An attic without electricity. Spooky. TikTok, I can't acknowledge any of your questions. I probably have a moderator in there who can handle that. So please double tap that screen. If you like ghost stories, please double tap that screen. And my moderators, if you do gift also, my moderators will thank you accordingly. The Dana House. One of Frank Lloyd Wright's most famous and intriguing homes is the Dana House in Springfield, Illinois. Construction started in 1902, and the huge house was finished in 1904. It's a magnificent example of Wright's prairie style. The first of Wright's designs to feature two-story rooms, like the hall, the gallery, and the dining room. Frank Lloyd Wright fans and architecture enthusiasts drool over this house, which features a library with glass-fronted built-in bookcases, a billiards room, and a bowling alley. And paranormal investigators salivate because, although management and state officials deny it, the Dana House is haunted. Very haunted. The Dana House was built at the request of Susie Lawrence, later known as Susie. You see it, don't you? Susie. Okay. Born in October 1862. Sue married, next time we have a Sue in the chat room, we're going to have some fun with that one. Married Edwin Ward Dana on December 4th, 1883. The marriage was short and fraught with financial troubles. Edwin Dana was a businessman, but not a very good one. Starting out as a real estate investor, Dana set himself up as president of the Western Business Agency. When that failed, his father-in-law sent him to Oregon to manage some mines. In Oregon, Edwin suffered a fatal accident in one of the mines. Susie came back to Springfield, her spirits in tatters. Her husband was dead, and she had also buried two infant children that she'd been unable to carry to term. On February 17th, 1901, a few years after Susie's return from Oregon, her father passed away. R.D. Lawrence's death was another blow to the young widow, but it left her with a financial windfall. She decided to build a grand new home for herself and the surviving members of her family. Her mother and her grandmother, who had passed away a year and a half later in August 1902, were also included, and her cousin Flora Lawrence. Wanting the sophistication of a Chicago architect could bring to sleepy Springfield, she tapped Frank Lloyd Wright for the job. Susie Lawrence Dana, got me there, lived a life marked by tragic losses, despite her elegant surroundings. She married a concert singer from Denmark in March 1912. Jorgen Constantin Dahl was half Susie's age, so it was quite the scandal. He died just a year later. In 1915, she married a native of Springfield, Charles Gurman. They eventually separated, and she divorced him in 1930. Susie had no head for money. In 1915, she received about $10,000 in income from her father's rental properties. Unfortunately, she had borrowed $132,000 to fund her lavish lifestyle. Susie turned to the spirit world for advice and consolation. She held seances in her home, on a regular basis, inviting the cream of Springfield society. Maybe some of that spiritualist energy is imbued in the walls of the gracious home. Susan Lawrence passed away on February 20th, 1946, but her spirit still seems to linger in her beloved home. In life, Susie loved to throw parties. She started things off with a bang during the holiday season of 1904, the year the house was finished. She hosted lavish holiday parties. She followed those up with housewarmings for the women's club, parties for the local children, including those in orphanages, dinners for residents of nursing homes, and a special gala for families of the workers who had built the house. And apparently, Susie still loves the holidays. Don't we all? I love the holidays. I'll probably haunt this house when I'm gone. Then again, maybe not. I'm just saying. I spoke with Mike Anderson, a folk musician, also jovially known as the Dulcimer Guy. Ooh, he's a dulcimer player. Along with other musicians, Mike performs for the open houses held at the Dana House every December. Mike has been performing at the home for nearly 40 years, and he readily admits to several chilling experiences. He claims that the house definitely has its own personality. Mike brings a unique perspective of a musician to his experiences. One of the favorite places to put a musician is above the front door. There's a balcony there, he said. There was one year, myself and a vocalist and a guitar player were doing Christmas music on that balcony. The sun was pouring through a window, and that sun was hot. The musician's shifts were 8 hours long, with the musicians playing in 2 to 3 hour stints. The other two performers took a break, leaving Mike on the balcony to play a solo. Suddenly, the balcony got deathly cold, to the point where I could barely move my fingers to play. And it stayed that way for about 10 minutes. During another Christmas open house, one of the performers was a young violin player, a boy of about 12 or 14 years old. As the seasoned performer, Mike led the boy to the balcony where his violin music would dazzle guests coming in through the front door, while Mike set himself up in the gallery. As Mike went towards the gallery, he heard the boy's panicked voice calling him back. Mike returned to the front door and looked up at the boy. The violin player peered down at him, his face a picture of woe. "I can't play here," the boy said. "Why not?" "I don't know." The boy, a budding professional, was clearly chagrined at his own behavior. But when he mentioned that his fingers were freezing cold, Mike realized immediately what the issue was. He switched places and sent the young violinist to the gallery instead. Mike shared another strange experience he had in the Dana House, and again it happened regularly during Christmas open houses. The house is set up so that you can pretty much tell where people are from the sound of their voices, Mike told me. He was set up to play on the balcony, and he kept an ear cocked for approaching tour groups. When a tour came within earshot of the balcony, Mike would start playing a Christmas carol on the dulcimer. One day, One day, as the tour group came up, Mike dropped into "What Child Is This?" Oh my gosh, that would be gorgeous on the dulcimer. He noticed a woman walking several steps behind the tour group. She was wearing a long winter coat in deference to the season. The group moved on into Susie's bedroom, but the woman in the long coat stopped on the steps leading down to the bedroom, just off the balcony. From the corner of his eye, Mike saw the group go into the room while the woman hung back. Mike turned to say to her, "You need to catch up with your group." But the woman was gone. This happened several times, and each time, Mike had just launched into "What Child Is This?" on the balcony. "It got to where I could almost make her appear just by playing that particular carol," Mike told me. Later, a harp player joined the ensemble of performers. She'd been at the house before, so Mike asked, "Is there any place you don't want to be stationed?" The harp player shrugged. "Not really, but the balcony can get pretty weird." Mike nodded fervently. "I know exactly what you mean." And he told the harpist his story. The harpist's face paled. "You mean you've seen her too?" Creepy. "I am your brother." Rufus Porter was a well-regarded journalist. Oh, right, journalist like me, who lived in the Pikes Peak region near Cascade, Colorado. Porter was known as the hard rock poet, and he wrote many short poems about the human condition. Not fancy poetry, but words that ordinary people could enjoy. In December of 1960, Porter was riding the rails from Spokane to Seattle for want of a ticket. He was huddled in an open boxcar. When the train started to cross the Cascade Mountains, the temperature, already brutally cold, fell to below zero. Porter knew he couldn't survive much longer. Near Leavenworth, Washington, he caught a glimpse of a work camp. He jumped the train and headed painfully towards the camp to seek shelter. He made his way to the watchman's cabin, where a light burned a cheerful welcome in the window. With the last of his fading strength, porter pounded on the door. An older bearded gentleman, with kind eyes, opened the door. He ushered Porter into the cabin out of the bitter cold. He sat him down next to the fire, knelt before him, and slipped his cold boots off. He fed Porter and treated his frostbite. But when Porter tried to thank him or engage him in conversation, the man would only reply with one simple phrase, "I am your brother." After a night spent in a warm, comfortable bed, Porter left the work camp and made his way to Leavenworth. When he got to town, he told the story of being rescued by the watchman and of being invited into the warmth and safety of the cozy cabin. Porter's tale was met with sideways looks and outright denial. The work camp outside of town had been deserted for years, people told him, and the watchman, who had supposedly cared for him, was long dead. Porter refused to believe this. The man's glances of kindness, his generous care, the humble way in which he would say, "I am your brother," it all stayed planted firmly in Porter's mind. He decided to go to the work camp in daylight to see things for himself. He found the camp abandoned, just as the men in town had told him. There was no sign of life anywhere in the camp, and the ashes of the fire on the hearth in the watchman's cabin were cold and dead. Next, the thing at the foot of the bed. Just like superheroes, all paranormal researchers, that's us, superheroes, all paranormal researchers have their origin story, the event that launched them on their careers as investigators of the unknown. Author Stephen Lancaster came to his first supernatural experience earlier than most. He was just 10 years old when he was attacked by an invisible entity in his bed. Lancaster remembers the date vividly. It was December 14th, 1987, and he was living in a small town in western Maryland with his parents and younger brother. The family had moved in several months before. Stephen recalls that particular Christmas was to be their first in the new house. As the older kid, his little brother was just 5. Stephen felt perfectly justified in claiming the top bed of the bunk bed set, when the family moved in. The boys' bedroom was chilly at night. The house was heated by a coal furnace, and its warmth struggled to reach the second floor. Up on the top bunk, it was even chillier, but it was worth it to Stephen to have the prized spot. On the night of December 14th, the boys had gone to bed at 9. But of course, going to bed and going to sleep mean two very different things, in kids speak. Stephen and his brother horsed around for a while, keeping quiet to stay off of the parental radar. After a couple of hours of covert play, Stephen's little brother was ready to actually go to sleep. He dropped off almost immediately. Stephen, on the other hand, lay awake for a while, tossing and turning in the chilly room. Around 1 in the morning, Stephen clocked out too. He came fuzzily awake to something pulling on his ankles. He couldn't see much in the dark room, but something was grasping his ankles and pulling gently. Of course, Stephen assumed it was his little brother. Stephen hung his head over the side of the top bunk, peering down to the bottom bunk. His brother looked like he was sound asleep. Stephen shook his head. Leave it to a pesky little brother to try a trick like that. He snuggled back down into his warm nest and closed his eyes. He had almost dozed off when he felt another tug on his ankles. This one was harder. Again, Stephen poked his head over the bed rail, hoping to catch his brother diving under his own blankets. And again, he heard nothing. No giggle, no nothing. And his brother looked dead of the world. At that point, it occurred to Stephen that his brother might not be the one responsible for the ankle tugging. His sleep-fuzzed brain was waking up, and he was beginning to realize that it was virtually impossible for his brother to invade Stephen's domain, give him a tug on the ankle, then slip back under his covers undetected and pretend so convincingly to be fast asleep. As Stephen was mulling over this puzzle, he realized that some invisible something was slowly pulling his blanket down towards the foot of his bed. He reached for his blanket to pull it back, and something grabbed both of his wrists. Imagine someone grabbing you around the wrists. You know what that feels like. This is exactly what happened. Something was holding on to me and not letting go. The skin around my wrist was actually indented, as if someone were physically grabbing me. Stephen would write much later in his book, True Case Files of a Paranormal Investigator. It's a straightforward description of stark terror. The unseen entity had hold of Stephen, and whatever it was, had no intention of letting him go. Within moments, Stephen felt weak, drained of energy, okay, and the entity was still pulling him down to the foot of the bed. Moments before, Stephen had sat upright to reach for the retreating blankets. Now, the phantom yanked him forward, flipping him so that his feet were on the pillow. And still, he was tugged, pulled relentlessly towards the foot of the bed. Stephen tried to drag in a breath to scream, but it was like trying to yell in a dream. Instead of a full-throated holler for help, Stephen's cries of "Mom, Dad" came in thin, whistling gasps. And yet, he still struggled fighting with the wiry kid's strength against the invisible monster that held him in his clutches. Suddenly, Stephen broke free. He had been tugging so hard, he overbalanced and crashed into the wall. The back of his head hit the wall so hard it left a dent in the wood paneling. Stephen found his voice. "Mom!" His parents came running. His little brother was roused from sleep. Everyone piled into the room as Stephen stammered out his incredible story. Despite the evidence of the head-sized dent in the wall, Stephen's parents wrote the story off as an amazingly vivid nightmare. The boys were soothed back to sleep, but a paranormal investigator was born that terrifying night. There is an interesting postscript to this story. In 1987, Stephen's parents both dismissed his tale. Theirs was a Christian home, and such talk was discouraged. But many years later, Stephen was talking with his mother about that long-ago night, and she decided to share a secret with him. When Stephen's mother was herself 10 years old, the exact same thing had happened to her. Her encounter with the invisible entity was so violent it left visible marks on her wrists where she was pulled towards the foot of her bed. Okay, next is the mystery of St. Luke's Church. This story happened in Liverpool, England, in the early 1990s. It has never been explained. The story begins one foggy December evening in 1991. On the evening of December 20th at 7 p.m., the Edwards family of Dovecot decided to do a bit of late Christmas shopping in Liverpool. Mr. Edwards drove his wife and four children to town in his old Volvo estate. Many people had similar plans for the evening, and finding a place to park was a chore. Mr. Edwards trolled the streets looking for a parking spot, while his daughter and three sons, too, excited to fuss, watched the spectacular Christmas decorations slide by the car windows. Abby, the youngest, 6 years old, was especially entranced with the colorful lights. As Mr. Edwards grumbled about parking, Mrs. Edwards pointed to a secluded side street called Bold Place. "That's perfect," Mr. Edwards said. He turned and drove up the poorly lit cobblestone road, which ran past the back of St. Luke's Church. As soon as the car was parked, the kids jumped out of the vehicle, bubbling with excitement. Meanwhile, an icy fog began to roll down the street. The family was about to start off for the shops when Mr. Edwards suddenly stopped short and glanced around the short street. "Where's Abby?" Everyone looked around. Mr. Edwards peered in the windows of the car, but his little daughter was missing. There was a tremble in Mr. Edwards' voice. "Where is she?" The three boys looked around, but there was no one else on the street. Then they all heard a faint voice scream out in the distance, "Daddy!" The voice sounded like Abby's. It seemed to come from the end of the lane, where Bold Place met Roscoe Street. The Edwards family rushed up the cobbled road, with Mr. Edwards leading the way. Abby, he shouted, "Where are you?" The gates at the back of St. Luke's were open, and Mr. Edwards figured that Abby had wandered through the gate and onto the grounds of the old church. He hurried into the churchyard, followed closely by their sons, and again they heard Abby call out for her daddy. But the little girl was nowhere to be found, and the fog was getting thicker by the minute. Mr. Edwards didn't want to say this in front of his family, but he was beginning to wonder if some stranger had grabbed Abby and taken her into the ruins of the old church. He handed his wife the car keys and told her to get a flashlight from the vehicle. When Mrs. Edwards came back, Mr. Edwards climbed up onto the ledge of the church window and shone the light into the deserted church. The interior was in ruins, with nothing but rubble scattered around. Mr. Edwards knew that the Church of St. Luke had been gutted by a bomb in World War II during the Blitz. Only the shell of the building had survived. The church had been left in that condition as a reminder of the horrors of war. Even though it was in ruins, though, Mr. Edwards couldn't shake the thought that Abby's voice had been calling for help from the inside of the church. As he clambered down from the window ledge, Mr. Edwards said, "Listen." The faint, eerie sounds of organ music drifted through the open window. The family went to the police station and told the desk sergeant about their lost child. The sergeant alerted all the patrol cars in the area and told the officers in the city center to be on the lookout for the young girl. The family then rushed back to Bowl Place to keep looking for Abby. They searched the grounds of St. Luke's once again and found nothing. They were about to go to the car to warm up when something happened that continues to puzzle the Edwards family to this day. A tall man, wearing a top hat and a long black coat, came out of the grounds of St. Luke's, and walking with him, holding his hand, was little Abby. When Abby saw her parents, she ran to them and started to cry as her father picked her up. The sinister man in black looked like something out of the Victorian age. He had long, bushy sideburns, a pallid face, and staring, ink-black eyes. He stood outside the gates of the churchyard and said in a low, creepy voice, "Please accept my sincere apology for any distress caused." Then he turned and walked slowly back towards the car, or towards the rear of the church. A police patrol car came tearing down the road, and Mr. Edwards told the officers about the stranger, who had just returned his daughter. Three police officers bolted from their car and rushed into the church, but the police found no one. The church was empty. More police came. The grounds were searched with powerful flashlights, but the place was deserted. Some of the officers also heard the faint sounds of organ music, but they never could find where the mysterious music was coming from. One of the policemen asked Abby where she had been, and that's when things got really weird. Abby said that an old woman in a shawl had grabbed her and dragged her into the church, where a mass was being held. There were many people dressed in old-fashioned clothes. The women wore big hats, and the men were all dressed in black. Abby had screamed for her father, but the old woman had put her hand over the girl's mouth to keep her quiet. Sometime later, a tall man had come into the church and pulled Abby from the woman's clutches. He had been the man who had taken Abby back to her parents. The intrigued policeman continued to interrogate the little girl, and he asked her if the man had spoken to her about what had happened. Abby shook her head. The man said he had been a long time dead, that's all. A cold shudder ran up everyone's spine when they heard Abby's reply. Since that strange incident, the Edwards family has refused to go anywhere near St. Luke's, especially during the Christmas season. Ah, the Gutenberg Poltergeist. Kind of funny that the name Gutenberg would come up, because when we finish this book, we're going to be reading books from the Gutenberg Project. And the Gutenberg Project has a bunch of books that are out of copyright, and so you're able to read them, and there's some classic books in there, like we've read Dracula and Frankenstein, the Gutenberg Poltergeist. On December 17, 1959, the William Mayer House near Gutenberg, Iowa, was the scene of excitement that had nothing to do with the upcoming holidays. A poltergeist took over the house, and soon no one in the family was in the Christmas spirit. One evening, as the Myers were sitting in their living room, a crash thundered through the house. The couple raced into the kitchen, where the source of the bang was immediately apparent. They found the refrigerator tipped over. As they watched, horror struck as a flour stand flew across the room and exploded against the stove. Movement near a basket of eggs on the windowsill caught their eye next. One egg lifted out of the basket, floated across the room, and smashed itself on the kitchen door. The Myers were dumbfounded. Mrs. Meyer was terrified. The inexplicable was in their home. In their kitchen, the heart of the home, yeah. What on earth was going on? The Myerses hadn't had supper yet, but Mrs. Meyer was far too upset to cook in that kitchen. The couple went out to eat instead. Out of the house, among the chatter of the other diners, the Myers could almost forget the high strangeness of earlier. Mrs. Meyer felt herself relaxing. Surely there was some rational explanation for what had just happened. When they got home, the Myers got ready for bed. It had been a sorely trying evening, and all they wanted to do was go to sleep and try to forget the destruction in the kitchen. Mrs. Meyer got a glass of water and put it on the nightstand. Then she got into bed and reached for a book. A little light reading would relax her. There would be no relaxing reading that night. The glass rose from the nightstand and hovered over Mrs. Meyer's head as her husband watched in horror. Then the glass was squeezed in a powerful, invisible hand. It exploded, drenching her with water and shards of glass. Mrs. Meyer screamed. Her husband, Bill, just as terrified, insisted they move to the guest room. Mrs. Meyer dried herself off, and they moved to the other bedroom. They scooted under the covers like frightened children. Before Bill could even turn off the light, Mrs. Meyer shrieked again. Little black specks were appearing on the blanket. The Meyers looked up, mystified. Soot was falling on them from the ceiling, appearing out of nowhere to shower the bed with black grit. In the morning, Bill called the sheriff, who came out to the house to investigate. He was called away in the middle of a search, but he promised to come back. When the sheriff did come back, several hours later, the Myers met him on the front lawn. They'd been spooked yet again. The sheriff hadn't witnessed any activity during his walk through the house, but after he left, several chairs had skidded across the floor. Even stranger, every single window in the house had cracked, but the Myers hadn't heard any sounds of breaking glass. This was the most excitement Clayton County, Iowa, had seen in decades. People from Gutenberg and other towns started to show up unannounced at the Myers' home, searching for ghosts. One of these visitors was a Mississippi River towboat captain who came with some friends to investigate the strange tales. He admitted to the Myers that he didn't believe in ghosts. Mrs. Myers, a gracious hostess, despite her supernatural troubles, offered the men the use of the guest room for the night. The captain turned in while his friends stayed in the kitchen with the Myers, drinking coffee and getting better acquainted. A ruckus in the bedroom brought the group running. The befuddled captain was still lying on the mattress. The mattress, however, was on the floor, 8 feet away from the bed frame. After a few months of poltergeist activity, Bill Meyer and his wife had quite enough. They moved away, leaving the house empty. Curiosity seekers and amateur ghost hunters made the abandoned house their haunt for a while. The Myers eventually sold the house to their former neighbors, the Finnegans. To combat the vandals that had started using the house as a playground, Wallace Finnegan turned the house into a barn. Now, filled with hay instead of ghosts, the house lost much of its spooky appeal. The vandals finally left it alone. Okay. The tickling terror. Bill Plummer snuggled the covers up under his chin. He was finding it hard to fall asleep on that December night in 1939. He sighed, then turned over. Suddenly he jerked. It felt like his wife Gert was tickling his feet. Startled, he yelled out, "Hey, knock it off!" A sleepy mumble met his ears. Billy looked over at Gert, who was just waking up out of a sound sleep. Then her eyes widened, and she twitched away from him. "Billy, gosh, stop. That's mean. I hate being tickled." "Gert, I didn't do..." "Yeah." Billy squirmed. "I said stop. I didn't touch you. I've been asleep." Then Gert made a face and clambered out of bed. "If you didn't touch me and I didn't touch you, we need to check the bed for bugs." Billy sprang out of bed at the mention of bugs and switched on the light. Together, Billy and Gert stripped the bed. Sheets, pillowcases, even the mattress pad landed on the floor after good shaking. No bugs, thank goodness. Two pairs of hands made short work of putting the bed back together. The couple lay down, their fears calmed, to enjoy a peaceful night's sleep. They got no such thing. The invisible entity tickled them unmercifully. The plumbers giggled, cried, moaned, squirmed, pleaded. Eventually, the entity relented and allowed the exhausted couple a few hours of sleep. At 4 o'clock in the morning, a thump rattled the bed frame, jerking Billy and Gert from an uneasy doze. Billy slapped the light switch, but no one was in the room with them. At least no one they could see. A symphony of taps, rattles, and bangs played up and down the bed frame. For moments, the strange nocturnal noises continued. One night in February, a deep voice came from somewhere underneath the bed. "Is the baby asleep?" Gert shot from the bed and into the baby's room. To her immense relief, their infant son was sound asleep. In mid-March, Billy decided to try an experiment. He twisted a copper wire into one of the bed springs and ran it to a gas pipe in the kitchen. That night, for the first time in months, the plumbers slept peacefully. They woke the next morning refreshed and rested. The next night, the tickling and thumping was back in full force. Billy had had enough. So had Gert. On the first warm spring day, Billy took the bed apart and hauled it off to the Wichita dump. A new bed was a small price to pay for a good night's sleep. All right. The perfect Christmas tree. Let me have a little sip of water here, guys. Ugh. Mr. and Mrs. Hostetler had been out all that winter's day. They'd been on the hunt for the perfect Christmas tree. Mr. Hostetler, Dennis, well, if it were up to him, he'd have gotten one picked out in an hour, maybe less. A tree was a tree, as long as it looked okay. But the missus, she was mighty picky about some things, and today she was being almighty picky about her tree. This one was too tall. That one was too short. This one here was already dropping needles. For heaven's sake. That one, oh, that one just wasn't full enough. None of the trees would do at all. Dennis was getting hungry, which was making him cranky. Truth be told, it was his wife's particularness making him cranky. But he loved his wife and wanted to see her happy, so he put up with it. He did manage to convince her that they should give up the search for the perfect Christmas tree. Just for that afternoon. They could go out later, even the next day, but miracle of miracles. As they drove home, the wife spotted it. There it was, the perfect tree. There was only one teeny tiny problem with it. It was smack in the middle of a cemetery. Oops. Growing right out of a grave. But it was the perfect tree. The wife insisted. Dennis couldn't believe she was asking, truly honestly telling him, to cut a tree down in a cemetery. But the wife just had to have it, after all. It was the perfect Christmas tree. So, grumbling the whole way, Dennis tromped into the cemetery, hack-swish-hacked at the tree, dragged it out of the cemetery, and push-pulled it to the top of the car and tied it down. There, he got in the car and started it, already thinking of a hot bowl of soup at home. The road home was a winding country road. Coming around an especially tricky curve, the couple saw something strange. There was a man standing beside an old-fashioned horse and buggy, sort of halfway in the road. Dennis hit the brakes, and they made their way around the fellow, blocking the road. Just as they got past him, though, the man, horse, and buggy all vanished. Well, of course, that was very strange, but they didn't stop to investigate. But just before they reached home, they saw the horse and buggy again, with the man glaring at them. This time, they saw it on a ridge, silhouetted against the afternoon sky. They blinked, and it was gone. When they got home, the husband untied the tree, brought it in, set it up in the stand, and gave it a good, healthy drink of water for its trunk. Then he trudged off to the kitchen to find something to eat. The wife was over the moon with her perfect Christmas tree. She dragged out all the boxes of decorations and set about trimming the tree. She put on strings of lights and garland and took out all her favorite Christmas ornaments, reliving fond memories of Christmases past as she went. It didn't take her a terribly long time to decorate the tree, and soon she stepped back to admire her artwork. Then that's when she saw it, an ornament she certainly hadn't put there, something near the top of her perfect Christmas tree, a small ornament in the shape of a man and a horse and buggy. The woman shrieked with horror for her husband to come take a look. They both peered at the ornament and realized, both together, that the man looked an awful lot like the fellow they had seen twice on their way home. They got the funny feeling, looking at the tiny man, that he wanted to talk. His wife, her voice quavering, asked him what he wanted. And the little old man told him, in life, he'd been a selfish, horrible man. About the only thing he'd ever done right in his life was to cut down pine trees and give them away to folks for Christmas. But that he hadn't enough to save him from the thought of hellfire and damnation for the other bad parts of his life. Many years before, he'd been killed in a buggy crash. He'd lived just long enough to breathe his last instructions to his family. They must plant a pine tree on his grave. The tree would symbolize his generous acts, and so he'd eventually work his way into heaven. The day he was buried, his family honored his last wish and planted a seedling pine on his grave. Over the years, it had grown tall and strong. It had grown into the perfect tree. And then, after all this time, all those years of the tree growing, all those years of the man hoping to get into heaven at last, after all that, the selfish, ignorant, uncaring woman had come along and stolen his tree. A tree that, in life, he would have willingly would have cut down and given to her. She had cut down his special tree. There would be no forgiveness for such a crime. Strangely enough, the man didn't even blame the husband, who had actually been the one to cut down the tree. He knew it was the wife's doing. The little man's voice grew fainter as he spoke, as if he were on the verge of leaving. He blamed her one last minute for destroying his hope of getting into heaven. The last thing the little man told her was that the wife would suffer for the rest of her life for her thoughtlessness and disrespect. But, he added, a grim note in his voice, she wouldn't have to suffer for long. When the pine tree was dead, she too would die. The little man's prophecy came true. Despite their best efforts to keep the tree alive, it died. And a month to the day after the tree was cut, so did the wife. See? Don't cut Christmas trees in a cemetery, kids. Not good for your health. A rose for her hair. In September 1908, the Harrell family moved into a big three-story mansion in Norfolk, Virginia. Son Eddie, an only child, was given the bedroom on the third floor at the front of the house. But as he was away at a private school, he didn't use the room right away. Another third-floor room, the one down the hallway from Eddie's, was assigned to the family's two servants to share. But very soon after they moved in, both servants came to Mrs. Harrell and asked to be moved to a different room. Something felt wrong in that room, they said. Strange noises, unintelligible conversations, just below a whisper, furniture moving by itself. Mrs. Harrell told the servants they were just being foolish. But being a kind and considerate employer, she soon relented and let them move out of the haunted room. They had no problems in their new quarters. Eddie Harrell came home from his holiday break a week before Christmas. He settled into his room and slept there peacefully until New Year's Eve. That night, Eddie was woken during the night by the overhead light turning on and off by itself. Groggily, he opened his eyes and saw a young woman standing next to the window. She was beautiful, dressed in white, with a brilliant red rose tucked into her black hair. One hand was at her temple, as if to shield her eyes from the light. Still half asleep, Eddie mumbled to the girl and asked her what it was she wanted. At the sound of his voice, the girl vanished, and the lights went out. At breakfast the next day, Eddie told his parents what had happened. Mr. and Mrs. Harrell passed the experience off as a dream, but too nonchalantly asked Eddie not to mention the dream to the servants. At Easter, the Harrells had an out-of-town guest visiting. While sitting at breakfast, the friend happened to glance out into the hallway and saw a young lady in white pass by the open hall door and go up the stairs. The friend was able to describe the lady quite clearly. She was wearing a white dress made of lace with capless sleeves and a train, and she wore a single red rose in her shining black hair. Later that night, Eddie saw the ghost for a second time. This time, he managed to ask the young lady who she was and what she wanted. The spirit again vanished. But at that time, at that same instant, he heard a woman's voice urge, "Wait." After that, the apparition was only seen at the Christmas holidays. The last time anyone saw the pretty ghost was during Eddie's senior year. Family was visiting for the holidays, and Eddie's cousin was supposed to sleep in the servant's old room. But during the holiday party, the men of the family had used it as their smoking room. So Mrs. Harold decided to put the cousin in Eddie's bedroom instead. Eddie agreed to sleep in the room the servants so feared. The Harolds decided not to tell the cousin about the ghost in Eddie's room, hoping she'd sleep soundly. Eddie, as agreed, went to sleep in the servant's old room down the hall. He fell asleep without incident, but once again, he was woken up in the middle of the night by the overhead lights coming on. And once again, he saw the young woman in the white lace standing by the window. This time, her hands were over her face. Eddie quietly got out of bed, but as soon as his feet hit the floor, the spirit was gone. After yet another visit from the beautiful young ghost, Eddie couldn't sleep. He sat up in a chair and read for a while. He nodded off over the book and slept through the rest of the night in the chair. At breakfast, the cousin told the Harolds about the strange vision she'd had in the night before. She woke up to find her overhead light on. She could see through the walls that separated her room from the one Eddie was using. You were in your nightshirt, and you were sitting in a chair with a book in your hands. There was a woman in white standing behind you, as if she was reading over your shoulder. The cousin described the woman exactly the way the Easter guest had done years before. The rose fell out of her hair, the cousin added. It was lying on the floor by the chair, and then the whole scene vanished. After breakfast, Eddie and his father snuck upstairs to the room where Eddie had spent the night. On the floor, next to the chair, was a fresh-cut red rose. Shortly after this, Mr. Harold passed away unexpectedly, and the family moved out of the house. Eddie never found out who the young lady was, or why she had appeared to him. But he kept the rose in a bell jar. He wrote that half a century later, the stem and the leaves had withered, but the blossom looked as fresh as if it had been cut in that day, instead of being dropped by a ghost 50 years ago. He never removed the glass cover or even thought of touching the rose's satiny petals for fear it would crumble into dust. Next one, Eternal Love. Jubal. Jubal Reeves was a mountain man, and he had a mountain-sized heart, too. He was the friendliest, kindest man of anyone in those hills and hollers. Jubal was always ready to lend his neighbors a helping hand, but he saved his truest devotion for his family, his beautiful wife Rebecca, and their four children. The little ones ranged from 10 years old down to the three-year-old baby. There were two girls, Hannah and Sarah, and two boys, Laban and David. Jubal doted on his children and their mother. He was constantly doing little things to show his affection for them. He dug flower beds for Rebecca around their cabin and filled them with the colors of nature and picked bouquets for her every time a new blossom opened. He carved little toys for the children from small chunks of wood, smoothing the splinters and rough edges carefully mindful of tender little hands. He hung swings in the trees so the children would have a lovely place to play. Whenever he made the trek down to the general store for supplies, he made sure to pick something up for his family, penny candy for the children, and a bolt of cloth for Rebecca. She was an excellent seamstress and took pride in keeping her growing family well-clothed. And when they attended Sunday services in their small mountain church, Jubal would sit, eyes closed, a smile on his face, as he listened to Rebecca lift her voice in her worshipful song, as if he were hearing angels sing. Jubal and Rebecca had been married for about 12 years when tragedy came to the family. During an exceptionally cold winter, influenza struck the mountain community. Jubal and Rebecca nursed the other families until the evening they came home and found their own children sick. Little David the baby of the family, passed away before the morning the next day. Rebecca Filial, at about the same time, they lost David. 10-year-old Hannah passed next. Rebecca lived long enough to know that Hannah had died before. She herself passed away. Left without his partner and soulmate, Jubal tried to keep 6-year-old Sarah and 8-year-old Laban alive, but the strain of grief and loss was too much for him, and he took sick as well. By the time the doctor came, Sarah and Laban were gone, and Jubal was delirious with fever. Jubal lay in a coma for a week before his fever broke. During that time, his neighbors did what folks back then did for each other. They took care of the laying out and the burying of his beloved ones. But Jubal was far too sick to say his final goodbyes. It was another few days before he was well enough to open his eyes and ask about Rebecca and the children. As gently as they could, the neighbors broke the shattering news. Rebecca, Hannah, Laban, Sarah, and David were all gone, buried in the yard near one of the flower beds Jubal had put in for his wife's enjoyment. Jubal didn't believe them. He refused to believe them. The doctor pronounced Jubal out of danger. The neighbors went home, their sad duty done. If Jubal lived alone in the cabin for, if Jubal lived alone in the cabin for a while, they figured, he would in time come to accept his loss. But it was not so easy as that. That spring, Jubal Reeves came down from his cabin to the general store. He was still very weak and deathly pale, but he was determined to make the trip to the store. His reason for it became clear when he asked the storekeeper for 5 yards of Gideon cloth. Rebecca wants to make a new spring dresses for the girls. Jubal told the astonished storekeeper, "They're just growing like weeds, and best throw in some stick candy for the boys and little ones too." The storekeeper, startled, asked Jubal if he really wanted all that after what had happened. Jubal gave the man a puzzled look in return, as if he honestly had no idea what the man was talking about. The storekeeper didn't have the heart to try to explain. In the end, he just sold Jubal the cloth and the candy along with his other supplies. As time went on, Jubal became even more fixed in his delusion. Occasionally, some neighbor would try to convince him that Rebecca and the children were waiting for him in heaven. But Jubal would never listen to such talk. He lived as if Rebecca and their children were right there with him, and they were living their lives all together as a family. He'd wash clothes and hang them to dry. He cooked for a family of six. He'd set the table for the meal, then wash all the dishes afterwards. And once a year, he'd ask a neighbor woman to sew new dresses for Rebecca and Sarah and Hannah, but always in the sizes they'd been when they died. The neighbor woman was kind and patient, and she faithfully made the dresses as Jubal asked. Many years later, when Jubal was old and feeble, a stranger happened to pass by the cabin. It was Christmas time, and the stranger was on his way to a nearby home and needed directions. He knocked on the door, and Jubal let him in. The cabin was brightly lit and freshly cleaned for the holidays. The stranger could see that Jubal was in the middle of setting the table for six. The cabin was festively decorated, and the good smells of cooking filled the air. Jubal was dressed in clean clothes, ready for a holiday celebration. He gave the stranger the directions that he needed, and the man went on his way. The stranger passed by his cabin, Jubal's cabin again on his way down the mountain. A couple of hours later, he was about to knock on the door again. He thought he might wish the old man a Merry Christmas and maybe warm himself at Jubal's fire for a bit, but something stopped him from raising his knuckles to the door. He could hear voices in the cabin, the giggles of young children, Jubal's happy voice as he played with them. Then a woman's voice, the most beautiful he'd ever heard, came to his ears. She was singing in an old mountain carol, and it sounded like angels singing. The stranger decided not to interrupt such a cozy family gathering, so he let his hand fall and turned away. He rode back down the mountain. It was some time later that he heard the story of Jubal's losses and of his insistence that his family still lived. That was Jubal's last Christmas with his family. He died at the end of the summer of the next year, just when the leaves began to turn. His neighbors found him sitting in a chair near Rebecca's flower beds. They buried him with his family right there in the yard. Mountain legends say that maybe Jubal's devotion to his family was so strong that it brought them back from beyond the veil to spend that one last Christmas with him. And when the mountain folk want to pay someone the very highest compliment, they say, have a love like the love of Jubal Reeves. Okay. Guides in the snow. Where are we at? Okay. It was just a couple of days before Christmas, 1860. Dr. John O'Brien, a country doctor practicing in rural Missouri, had just sat down to supper with his wife, Elizabeth. The meal Elizabeth had made was perfect fare for a cold, blustery winter's night. Hot fried chicken, buttery mashed potatoes, yeah, and bread fresh out of the oven. But Dr. O'Brien could only pick at his food. The young doctor was famous in the area for his intuition, a sense that went far beyond duty to his patients. And that intuition was niggling at him now, telling him to visit one of his patients. Mrs. Kilpatrick had heart trouble, and if she was in distress, couldn't wait until the morning. O'Brien set his fork down and explained to Elizabeth that he had to go see his patient. Elizabeth nodded her understanding, but cast a worried glance at the snow spinning against the window. O'Brien dressed warmly for the ride, but even so, the blizzard's winds swirled fiercely around him, cold fingers seeking a way into his heavy overcoat and under his thick woolen scarf. He made his way to the stable and hitched his sturdy horse to the buggy. The howling winds and driving snow hit him full force when he turned out of his lane and onto the road. O'Brien gripped the reins with his fur-lined gloves and urged the horse forward, praying that the beast could keep his footing on the slippery road. The familiar landmarks were buried under drifts of snow. O'Brien peered through the swirling flakes, trying to see the turn he had to take to get to the zigzag path to the Kirkpatrick's house. His sense of duty to his patient throbbed, but the storm raced fiercely around him. If he took the wrong road, he'd be wandering the countryside for hours in the cold and dark. Should he just give up and head home? Just then, he heard a noise under the howl of the wind. It sounded like the barking of a dog, a big dog. No, not just one. There were two of them. Then, in the shallow pool of yellow light, cast by his buggy lantern, O'Brien saw them. They were two big black dogs. God only knew what breed. One on each side of his horse. The horse snorted and stamped, but didn't bolt from the huge beast. The dogs barked again and bounded off through the snow, their shaggy black bodies easy to see as they moved through the white drifts. Oh, they must belong to some family around here, O'Brien thought, as he touched the horse into a fast walk. He didn't remember the Kilpatricks having big dogs like these, but maybe they were working animals, not allowed indoors. The dogs kept up their barking, looking back over their shoulders, almost as if they were making sure O'Brien was following. The doctor decided to trust his intuition once again, and he followed the big black dogs. The dogs waited patiently for the buggy to catch up, leading the horse down the winding road to Kilpatrick's home. O'Brien doubted he would have found the turnoff without the dog's help. Finally, a light glimmered in the distance, and the doctor allowed himself a sigh of relief. Moments later, he recognized the Kilpatrick's house. He pulled up, parked his buggy in the shed with a pat for his faithful horse, and went up and knocked on the door. Mr. Kilpatrick opened the door. Dr. O'Brien, what on earth? The doctor shrugged out of his snow-crusted boots and overcoat. I had a feeling, that's all. How is Mrs. Kilpatrick? Not well. I'm afraid that intuition of yours is sure a blessing. We owe you thanks for coming out on such a vicious night. The doctor warmed his hands briefly at the fire, then went in to see his patient. As her husband had said, Mrs. Kilpatrick was doing poorly. Her breathing was labored, and her color wasn't really very good. O'Brien reached for her wrist, and he felt for her pulse. "Thank God you're here, doctor," the woman mumbled. "I had the strangest dream about you. Dreamed you were driving in a storm with two great big black beasts at your side." Her voice trailed off as O'Brien stared at her. Numbly, he noted her low, steady pulse. He turned to his bag and rummaged through it, looking for the packet of heart medicine. He mixed it in water and eased his patient up to drink it. Soon, her breathing eased. Her pulse grew steady, and she drifted into sleep. It was then that O'Brien realized that he hadn't heard the dogs bark in some time. As he gratefully accepted the late meal from Mr. Kilpatrick, O'Brien asked him about his dogs. The man shrugged. He didn't own dogs like that, nor did anyone in the area. The doctor spent the night watching over his patient. The next morning, Christmas Eve, she was well out of danger. As O'Brien drove home, he kept a sharp watch for the big black dogs. He even whistled and shouted for them a few times. But they had vanished with the blizzard's winds. He never saw the dogs again. Okay, guys, well, that's it till next week. Again, I don't really know how much farther we have to go. I know we're coming to the end of the book, but we will continue next Sunday on this, and it might be a short Sunday. So what I'm going to go ahead and do this week, like I was talking with you guys, I'm going to go ahead and go over to Gutenberg tonight, and I'm going to pick 5 books over at Gutenberg, and I'm going to give you guys a choice which one you would like to hear. Okay, so just in case next Sunday, if the book does finish, we can just pop right into the Gutenberg book. All right, so that'll be your choices. I'll do it for both you guys over here, and we'll do it for you guys over TikTok, you know, as far as the book. So I'll give you guys a choice, and I'll pull the book tonight. We'll see what we can do to give her. And then Friday afternoon, when Nancy Mass comes on, because I don't have any shows booked this week. I have a bunch of shows booked for the week after. But this coming week, there's no shows booked, except for Nancy. So on Friday afternoon, when Nancy does her show, I'll give you guys a choice on what books you guys would like to read, would like me to read, and you can pick and choose. And you guys over at TikTok, same thing. Okay? All right? So anyway, that'll do it for this week. I appreciate each and every one of you being here. For you guys over at TikTok, and I've been saying this all week, TikTok is going to go black. You know, unless somebody purchases it the next 69 days, TikTok is going away, okay? And we went black once already, and I'm trying to encourage you guys to join us. We have new homes. If this happens, it's all set up and ready to go. We have a home over at Clapper, that's C-L-A-P-P-E-R, and we also have a home at Favorited. That's favor with an I-T-E-D at the end, okay? Look us up over there, because if it does go black, we are not going, you won't be able to find us except on YouTube, Facebook, or the other ones, but we're not going live on, you know, the only live we're doing over there is the radio show, not the regular readings or anything like that. So join us over at those other two places, and I encourage you to sign up for both, because we're starting to establish ourselves over at Clapper. We're getting a following, but it's very important. Yes. Yeah, JJ. But it's very important. I see Debbie in there. I see JJ. I see Maurice in the chat room. You guys, I can't see you over there on that screen, so I'm hoping Lori or somebody's watching you guys. Is Lori in there? Oh, Panthea. Yeah, I see people in there from my usual show. So, yeah. So I need you guys to sign up for both, because while we are starting to build ourselves up over at Clapper, I do want to build myself up at Favoriten as well. Okay, because there's two options for us to be at. So if you guys could sign up over those two places, it's free. They're a lot like TikTok. Come on over, join us. It's all under California Haunts. All right, that's going to do it. And tonight I'm going to be spending time filling out paperwork for a doctor's appointment tomorrow. There won't be breakfast with the ghost hunter at 11 a.m. tomorrow. We will not be doing it because I will be at the doctor's office for pain management. So I got to fill out all their entry paperwork and all that. So tomorrow night, though, I'll be back at 6 p.m. Pacific. We're going to do some voice box stuff again, you know, to do some ghost hunting here right in my studio. So we'll be doing that again tomorrow at 6 p.m. Pacific, followed by tarot card readings at 7 p.m. Okay? All right, guys. Thank you. I'm going to shut. Hang on a second over here. I'm going to shut TikTok down. Thank you very much, everybody that came over from TikTok. Appreciate it. Have a good evening, you guys. Okay. 378. Not bad, not bad, not bad for a Sunday. All right, you guys, like I said, I'm working on booking some guests. I'll be doing that tonight after I get the paperwork done for my, you know, for my medical stuff. Also, next Sunday, I think it's my birthday. I can't remember. And I've had requests because we've been listening to 50s music at night over on TikTok during the live show. So I think we're going to go to the 50s restaurant, and I'm going to go live and take you guys with me. That's what I think is going to happen. Okay, so we're working on that, putting that together, and we'll be going live. Might be on TikTok. I don't know if it's going to be TikTok or it's going to be Clapper, but either one, we're going to be live on. So anyway, I want to thank everybody, and we'll see you guys for sure on Friday with Medium Nancy Maths if something else doesn't come up this week. And then I should have consistent shows. I've got 3 weeks of shows booked out already past next week, so we're going to be rolling with it. We're going to be rolling with it. So anyway, thank you guys so much, and I hope you have a great rest of your Sunday, and enjoy. Have a good one, everybody.